Paper Ghosts is a production of iHeartRadio.
We're hoping that a family member, a friend, a neighbor, or someone else will recognize this person and come forward to investigators with information that will lead to the identity.
For just a moment in 2013, there was a glint of hope that the remains of one of the missing girls had been discovered. A 23-year-old college student looking to collect scrap metal for an art project was walking through the woods near his home in Vernon when he came across a female skull and other human remains. At first, there was a strong belief among Vernon police that they could have belonged to either Janice Pocket, Lisa White, or Debbie Spickler. And for April White Folletti, Lisa White's sister, this discovery was the first time ever that felt as though her sister was finally coming home.
In my heart, I never thought it was anybody else but Lisa. It was too close to home. I just had a gut feeling that it was my sister. And all I wanted was, at that point, closure for myself, closure for my mom. It was like a knife in my heart when we found out.
The remains were found in a rugged area that was once a town dump site. It was an area not only close to where Lisa White lived, but where she had frequently hung out with friends. It became a harrowing 4 days before the results of whether any of the dental records provided a match to one of the missing girls.
Took forever, or at least I don't even remember how long. For me, it felt like years getting the answer, just waiting. And it was right before my birthday, and I just kept saying to myself, all I want for my birthday is this to be found as Lisa. That's all I wanted.
Years went by before police positively ID'd the remains as that of a petite 43-year-old woman who had gone missing years earlier. These families, I cannot say it enough, live with this daily. A body found, a knock on the door, a telephone call. They get their hopes up, and it's back to reality. No answers.
I get a call from one of the Vernon PD detectives, and so I'm holding my breath, and they said, we've got the conclusion that this isn't your sister. These remains are not your sister. And I immediately just sat on the floor like somebody just punched me in the gut. And then the tears just came and came and came.
Previously on Paper Ghosts.
It opens up a can of worms and takes us down a rabbit hole. But even after all that, I go back and I'm like, where does that leave us? It leaves us with the question still, where is Debbie Spickler? What happened to her?
A lot of them looked the same. So we started looking at, is this more than one person? Was this sort of like a, you know, somebody that was doing this in the area, you know, abducting children that age or around that age?
Somehow we crawled through Christmas. Lisa's presence lay there unopened. We existed through March. I was completely disillusioned by the local police.
My name is M. William Phelps. This is Paper Ghosts. For as long as I've investigated the disappearances of the young girls, there has never been a shortage of people coming forward and willing to discuss the cases with me.
In the very beginning, they thought she'd wandered off.
Most of those details I've heard countless times.
And it was a missing person. It was a little girl who wandered into the woods.
But then every once in a while, I meet a new source who leaves me speechless.
I think I'm the only person alive still that actually worked on the case from the beginning.
The latter recently happened when a retired police officer who worked the Janice Pocket and Lisa White cases reached out to me with information he thought I'd be interested in. We met on a Sunday afternoon on the north end of Crystal Lake.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
The Wendell property and those water wells were to our right. The gorgeous lake sprawled out in front of us. After some discussion, we decided it better not to use his name. But I have verified his credentials, which are impressive. Not only did he retire at the highest rank in his department, but he's a lawyer as well. I was interested in what he had to say about Janice Pocket's case. She was the youngest of the girls who disappeared, and that image of her riding her bike to go find the dead butterfly continuously haunts me.
Now I think we're 2 days into it when I get the call that it's going to be an abduction of some type. Are you aware of the ransom calls?
For her?
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them. I mean, I've heard all kinds of stuff.
Okay. When Janice Pocket first disappeared, there were two calls, came two different days, and one of them was, make the reward $10,000, you might get your daughter back. That's probably verbatim what it was. I had heard it so many times. The other one was, make the reward $20,000 and you'll see Janice again. And somebody had the presence of mind on this police to put a tape recorder on the Pocket phone early on. So both of those calls were recorded. Now you gotta remember, technology then wasn't what it is today. It took days for them to figure out where the phone calls came from.
I asked him next if the blackmailer was possibly an opportunist and just trying to capitalize on the Pocket's pain and vulnerability.
Yeah, at the time, you didn't know.
Right.
But the phone calls came from the phone booth in the center of Tallinn, at the Tallinn Green, in front of where the old Tallinn jail used to be.
This area he's talking about is 1.8 miles from where Janice went missing. Just a 3-minute drive.
There was no way of knowing if there was going to be a third call. So we did surveillance. I was part of that on that phone booth. It would take days to trace the call, or at least many hours.
Yeah, yeah.
So and the idea was, well, we'll watch the booth, get the reg number of the call, and if at 2:14 we see somebody go in and make a call, we'll make the notation. But it didn't quite work that way, because you couldn't always see the reg of the vehicle and all that. But the interesting thing is the guy who made the call had a gravelly, old, distinct voice.
Those ransom calls never went anywhere. The old-sounding guy was never found. My gut tells me this was someone trying to capitalize on the pain of a missing child's family. Nothing more. Then, my source tells me a story about what happened about a month after Janice disappeared, and, well, it makes me think he had a very good person of interest in Janice's case. It wasn't Bob LaRosa. In the hours after law enforcement decided Janice Pocket had been abducted, my new source tells me a suspect quickly emerged once police began knocking on doors.
Doing the neighborhood canvas, an incident comes up from several different people, women, about a soda delivery man who is offensive, invites himself into the house, does things that would be very awkward and whatnot. His name was... He was fired because of this incident. Not because of Pocket, because these women or a woman complained, and apparently they had other complaints.
Then my source reveals this.
Served 20 years in prison for raping an 8-year-old girl in Connecticut.
So this pedophile served his 20 years for raping an 8-year-old girl, then goes to work delivering soda in Janice Pocket's neighborhood. And he's cruising around in a truck. I recall several people telling me over the years they had seen a truck in the neighborhood near the time Janice disappeared, but nothing had ever come of it. Now, after learning this, I wonder, was the alleged sighting of Bob LaRosa and his parked station wagon in the middle of the road an unlikely occurrence? Or is this new suspect just one of many creeps I'm learning about that often hung out in the area?
We got a search warrant for B's house. He lived with a woman right where the 7-Eleven is.
That address my source mentions? It's down the street a half mile from where Lisa White went missing. I mean, look, the coincidence is developing here. The locations, the criminal record, they're hard to ignore. This new suspect never admitted to Janice Pocket's abduction. And I've learned he was never ruled out as a person of interest. Just when it felt like my search for answers was finally producing the strongest leads yet, I'm hit with this new information changing everything. You'd think it would get easy every time an investigation gets thrown off course, but it's just another example of how these cold cases always seem to take one step back from bringing these families answers.
Let me ask you this. If another little girl on a bicycle disappeared 30 days after the Pocket case, within 5 miles of the Pocket house, would you think if you could solve one, you'd probably solve them both?
Yeah, absolutely. So that happened?
You don't know that then, do you?
Now that was information I had not heard.
That's interesting that another little girl, was it in Tolland or was it in Vernon?
Right over here.
He points straight ahead to the south side of Crystal Lake by the public beach, an area where the witness grew up. There are three narrow roads across from the public beach, which track upwards into a wooded area. Back in the day, these roads would have been dirt with dense forests on both sides.
An 11-year-old girl is riding her bicycle. She sees a car pass her. Car turns around, comes back, sees it pass her again, doesn't give it any thought. She goes a bit further. All of a sudden, a guy jumps out of the woods and drags her off the bicycle and is trying to take her into the woods.
And then this happened.
This is a one in a gazillion. A state trooper, a big red-headed kid from Chicopee, is coming down the road. He sees it happen. He jumps out and, you know, gets into a fight with the guy.
He tells me the guy's name. A name, incidentally, I have never heard. And it's not the soda delivery guy either. This is yet another scumbag trolling the streets looking for a young girl. I mean, two of these cases in this small area within a month? I think about this today and wonder, where the hell did I live growing up? What's more, the guy was a school teacher.
He was supposed to be in an orientation meeting for new teachers. He was supposed to be there. He wasn't there. Instead of being there, he was out here trying to pull a girl off a bicycle.
And then a month before, could you place him in Tolland near Pocket?
The day that this happened, I was there. I was in the barracks when they brought him in. And he was kind of lumped up, and they took a mugshot of him. And then if you saw him after, you'd never know it was the same person. It's just odd. He's one of those people where when he was cleaned up and had glasses on and everything, he had a very different look to him. He looked more like a school teacher. The day that brought him in, he looked like somebody who tried to pull a little girl off a bicycle.
I can't tell you how many times I have interviewed survivors of serial killer attacks who describe how the man who attacked them looked one way right before the attack and like a different person altogether just after. It's like that mask of sanity these guys wear comes off. My source went on to explain how, after some digging, they found out that this teacher was also a driving instructor in the next town over. So they began talking to his former driver's ed students. And there it was.
We found two girls, and we said, "Where did he take you?" And they said, "We went all over, mostly rural places or wooded places, because he raised hunting dogs and he would take us where he went hunting." So we said, "Okay, well, you know, can you take us?" And long story short, they led us to Tolland.
The police obviously wanted to question the teacher about Janice Pocket. They had several victims identify him for indecent exposure acts around the Tri-Town region. So they alternated filing arrest warrants. As soon as he was released on one, they'd slap another one on him and drag him back in. I then asked the obvious next question. What did he say about Janice Pocket?
This is so important and people don't understand it. He never denied taking Janice Pocket.
He never denied it.
Never denied it. He would talk to us until we got to that, and then he'd just sit there. He lawyered up. He got an attorney who eventually got a restraining order that we couldn't go within 100 yards of him. Because we were doing that. I mean, we were harassing him. It was, you know, what there was one victim who was a young girl. He pulled up, exposed himself to her. And, you know, she looked at the photos, and I think that might him, but it might, you know. And so we decided we'd do a lineup. And so we got four troopers in plain clothes. So we bring her in. If we had a videotape of the five people, it would have been priceless. We brought him in, and his knees buckled. He recognized her.
Wow.
She recognized him. You know, it was, you know, she identified him, and that was one more arrest we had.
How interesting.
Next thing they did was get a search warrant for the house the teacher lived in with his parents.
And up in the floor joists and the rafters up in the basement, we found a gun. It was a plastic gun. It looked very real. And the father said he puts them there. And the mother, I think, had some type of mental issue. She was sitting on the kitchen floor with wet towels on her head when we executed the search warrant.
For me, the plastic gun is significant. I'm thinking intimidation and control. You put a plastic gun in front of a kid, they don't know it's plastic. The prosecutor ultimately dropped the ball and cut a deal with this guy for no prison time, giving him instead accelerated rehabilitation under the condition he surrender his teaching license.
The thing that strikes me about was an only child. His parents were older. Now, what's significant about that is about 5, maybe 10 years later, father is arrested for sexually assaulting a nephew.
The house this guy lived in with his parents was about 20 minutes from where Janice Pocket was abducted.
But here's the thing. Has never left that house.
Really?
That bothers me.
He also never denied abducting and killing Janice.
Never. That's the thing that bothers me the most. You'd expect them to say, fuck you, are you crazy? You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Never, ever denied it. And
he hasn't left the house.
And he doesn't, you know, and it was, you know, most people move on, you know, like sell your parents' house, buy a bigger house. It's a small little house. And it just strikes me, why didn't he leave there? You know, and if his father was the evil bastard we think he is, wouldn't that be a house full of bad memories?
Oh, yeah.
I'd say, I want to dig up the yard.
Yeah.
I mean, really, I would do it. You see, I don't believe either White or Pocket were somebody, you know, nobody would have stumbled on. It's somebody who's from around here.
Who stalked them.
Yeah.
The new information I've received from my source has certainly given my investigation a shot of adrenaline. It's also not surprising. For as long as I have been investigating these disappearances, the number of leads and suspects ebbs and flows. I go north for a time, then a new bit of information sends me south. As much as you'd think men would want their names as far away from any possible connection, there were also those who tried to insert themselves, mostly for selfish purposes and sociopathic motivations. The most notable of them, Charles Pierce. In 1980, Pierce began admitting murdering over a dozen young girls. 58 years old, a former carnival worker from Haverhill, Massachusetts, Pierce killed a 13-year-old Boxford, Massachusetts girl in 1969, a Chicago, Illinois boy in 1973, and then he told Illinois investigators he had abducted and murdered 15 to 22 children between 1954 and 1978. Haverhill and Boxford are about a 90-minute drive from Tolland. In late 1980, Pierce told Connecticut State Police he knew where Janice Pocket was buried. The police looked into his claims and even brought his mugshot to Nancy McDonald, the neighbor who saw a man and his station wagon blocking the dirt road around the time Janice disappeared. Mary Engelbrecht, who you heard in Episode 1, has had a suspicion and really wanted to believe that Pierce was responsible for her sister's disappearance. Look, Pierce seemed to fit. And, well, he admitted his involvement. So I met up with Mary at a coffee shop one sunny afternoon in late August to clear up several unanswered questions.
The guy that they brought to the neighbor was Charles Pierce.
It was, okay.
Yep, it was Charles Pierce. And she's like, nope.
That wasn't him.
Not him. Because Charles Pierce, remember, says, I killed Janice. I know where she's buried.
Yep.
He also starts saying, I killed this one, I killed that one. He wanted some days out in the field.
That's what the detectives saw, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And he could give all these details, but then no detail about where she was actually buried because he changed his mind so many times.
What Mary says next tightens a few loose ends up for me. Remember the crime scene I walked out to with Lieutenant Bill Meyer and Terry Shanks, where Terry's sister Susan LaRosa's remains were recovered? It was a wooded area, old logging trail, by a reservoir that was once dragged for Janice's body not too long after she went missing. Charles Pierce had led police there, claiming he put Janice's and Debbie Spickler's bodies in that reservoir.
There was a place off a reservoir road he brought them to dig at one point. I don't think that was ever really widely known, but one of the former detectives told me that. But it definitely was a few spots on by Rhodes Road and Old Cat Hole there where they dug, I remember.
Rhodes Road is where Janice placed the butterfly. Cat Hole intersects with it about halfway down. All this searching and talk by convicted serial killers and convicts, it led nowhere. And yet, as I have learned, just when you think you've chased every rabbit down every hole, there's always another one to follow. Based off that tip police received from Tina LaRosa via her conversations with the witness about buried bodies in water wells, the Connecticut State Police, along with a detective from the Vernon PD, followed up and spent 3 days poking him, asking him questions. Afterwards, he left Tina a voicemail. I've listened to it. And let me just say this. The witness was more than pissed. Mary, in turn, had heard from the state police about the visit herself and wanted to share what she knew.
They were up there supposedly for 3 days. They questioned him all afternoon, took a break, went back in the evening, again the next day, and then the third day before they left. Vernon police went up with them. They questioned him, like, repeatedly, and they about stuff, and he said, I don't remember. I never said that. Then they would say, but it's right here in this report that you said that. And they'd show him, and he'd say, I don't remember. And they're like, they don't know if he was lying or really can't remember. They said it was hard to tell. Either he might just be a really good liar.
Like the other relatives of the missing girls, Mary understands these cases take one step forward, two steps back. At this point, it was impossible, really, for any of us to become disillusioned or surprised by what we heard.
They asked him the same questions in so many different ways to see if he'd mess up, you know, and stuff, but he really stuck to, they couldn't get anything out of him. Like, not a thing. Not any information. And they have, like, it doesn't sound like they have any intention of going back there unless he makes contact.
So close, yet so absolutely far. The witness has seemingly brought everyone to the brink of discovery, but is pulled back for some reason. In a second voicemail I heard, the witness had asked Tina for an envelope and postage so he could mail her a hand-drawn map of the wells and the exact location he was pointing to. Unfortunately, Tina, scared of giving the witness her address, never sent that envelope.
They weren't trying to make him seem like he was definitely guilty. They just wanted to know if he knew anything. But he denied knowledge about even Susan LaRosa dying. He knew nothing about that. He had no knowledge about how, what happened to her.
Obviously, that isn't true, as the witness and Bob were best friends and often hung out around the time Susan LaRosa disappeared. Despite all of that, however, it's time for me to reach out to the witness. At this point, I'm not really sure he is involved other than knowing Bob and Nathan LaRosa and possibly hearing details about the cases from them. but he's definitely an important piece of the puzzle law enforcement is putting a lot of credibility into. He's the only one of the men I've been looking at who is still alive. And, well, this might be my only shot.
Hello?
In the next episode of Paper Ghosts...
I'm the youngest person involved in it. And if I don't step up and try to help figure it out and I die, that's it. It goes away. Because nobody below me is going to care.
Look, for the last f***ing time, I didn't kill anybody. I didn't hurt nobody. I didn't kidnap anybody.
Paper Ghosts is written and executive produced by me, M. William Phelps, with help from producer Christina Everett and sound editing by Pete Cardi from Backroom Audio. A special thanks to Abu Safar and Will Pearson from iHeartRadio. The series theme, number 442, is written and performed by Tom Mooney and Thomas Phelps. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.